everybody, and welcome to another episode of Two-Headed Game Master. I'm Cosmo, the first head.
And I'm Dane, the pundit head.
Two-Headed Game Master is a podcast about... That was probably too long. The waveform is just a black ball. We got a third head again tonight.
Hello, I'm Brian, the That's What She's head.
Two-Headed Game Master is a podcast about writing, designing, running, and playing role-playing games, where we discuss our favorite hobbies, share our thoughts with you, and play some games sometimes. So, in the background of main episodes right now, we are playing the Fae Sisters Fate, a D&D module, and tonight we are going to be discussing and reviewing the Fae Sisters Fate as a product, as an adventure product.
That's right, back to our regular scheduled programming.
Yes. Hell yeah, it's my favorite program.
We have a guest star with us today.
Well, I don't know about star. Star feels a little too big for my bridges, you know what I mean?
Well.
More of a gas giant, if you know what I'm saying.
Hey!
I was going to say, you know, stars is like
which is
all
a type
of
star.
But, yeah.
Well, I mean, let's move on really quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So,
okay.
Regular episode format. We are going to be discussing this adventure product thing. Signposting. What are we gonna hit?
Drink. Well, it's gonna be a little probably meandering as a review goes, but we're gonna try to talk about some specific things such as the setting, the novel mechanics of the module, the flow, the organization. So if you have kept up.
If you
might be a patron.
you might be.
Well, might. Emphasis on might.
On might. So, we did a module. It is not fully released yet, but you definitely have access to the first and second episode, where we go through a pre-written module. Mm-hmm. The module is written for D&D. As Cosmo had previously said, it's called The Fae Sisters Fate.
By who published by who? Let's credit properly.
Okay.
It's also number two I'm now seeing.
Yes. Goodman Games published this. It's written by Chris Doyle.
Doyle rules. I made a movie reference. You got a drink.
You got a drink.
He did. And I didn't want to because I don't like that one or even that movie very much.
I don't
much.
Either.
You don't fuck with Adam Sandler, huh? I was looking for a publication date, but it's in the fine print and I don't care to read it.
How fine is it?
There is something about this, though, and I guess we're just getting into this. So this is the fifth edition. Fifth edition fantasy is the line of zines that this is a part of. So this is an issue of... Fifth edition fantasy.
Oh, it's an issue, all right.
Which I assume is just, you know, little magazines of adventure modules, but it says that the fifth edition one is here. So it seems to me like this is an older module that was, you know, revised and ported to fifth edition is
sure.
Kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Oh, interesting.
That being said, I don't know how important that is for what we're discussing, because I don't know that much about different editions of D&D and how they are comparing them to each other. I can't really speak to that.
2017.
There it is.
Okay.
I think also important, if you haven't been following along or maybe you've forgotten or whatever, we did not use a 5th edition rule set to play this module. We used our own little hack, Medium Dungeon, which if you want to trot on over to 2hgm.com, you can see. So it's just kind of a simplified rule set, kind of based on the D&D mechanics.
You play it the same as D&D, but we threw out all the ability scores and everything. You just, like, you have a proficiency score and health and armor class, and we've just reduced it. So if you know how to play Dungeons and Dragons, you can play this medium dungeon hack very mm-hmm. easily.
Yeah.
And it just means that you engage a lot less with all the things that have been written about how to play D&D, and you just kind of say what your character does. And if you continue to listen to the whole adventure, you'll hear us litigate some stuff. But I would say that having played, obviously, Medium Dungeon and, written it with Dane, and also played real Dungeons & Dragons, I don't think we missed out on anything important or engaged inauthentically with this D&D adventure module by not using official 5e.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know we're not here to review Medium Dungeon, but just throwing my hat in as a guy who spent most of his time RPGing in Dungeons & Dragons, specifically 5e, I feel like Medium Dungeon does a good job of sort of expediting some of the crunch, while still letting, I think, the things that are good about 5e shine through. And sort of watching Dane DM and, temporarily, throwing my DM hat on while he was doing it, I could kind of see where the system was working and allowing for things to move forward. So I don't feel like we missed out on anything, but I also am reading the book now, and this beauty's a little more than ethereal, Dane. You really, you undersold it, buddy. She's in studded leather, dude?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Studded leather could mean all kinds of things.
Well, sure. It means I got to come up with a safe word.
So as a setting, right, this book was written specifically for 5e.
Mm-hmm.
However, it didn't have, big references to the Forgotten Realms.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think, as players, and I can, share my insights as GM, how do you think it worked, and how did the GM do with integrating it into a setting, right? Because this is a module in a greater world, mm-hmm. right? So there's a whole setting behind this, but it was very, vague.
I don't know. I feel like that's the issue of a one-shot, is you sort of have to hand-wave some of that stuff anyways. I don't know that I got the sense I was in the Forgotten Realms. Also, the GM was bad.
So
a bad or a baddie?
He was a baddie.
He was a baddie. So I on purpose just didn't imagine us in the Forgotten Realms, because I don't like that setting very much. But I do really like just kind of classic fantasy,
mm-hmm.
and I love the sort of building blocks of Dungeons and Dragons, the Fae. That is a like a Pokemon type, basically. as opposed to, undead or infernal. And I like those things, and I like how they fit together, but, this is just a town in any
mm-hmm.
generic fantasy setting. So
yeah.
I imagine Warhammer Fantasy. That's my favorite just classic fantasy setting. I was like, this could be a town, anywhere in the old world. And this little secluded space where something weird is going on. I just, in the back of my head, I just dropped it into a world that I kind of knew and didn't really think about that very much.
Yeah. Same.
Because it hardly came into the adventure. So I think the way this adventure was structured and the way that you ran it, I had no problems with, the setting or fitting it in, or imagining that I had characters who would go here. It worked out fine.
Yeah.
And I only had to think about who they were outside of this up until a certain point, the characters that I played.
That's right. Which I think is just good one-shotting of sort of just letting you sort of immerse into the where you are. But yeah, I don't know how knowing the pantheon of gods or where the Sword Coast is relative to this would have helped the adventure one way or the other.
Yeah, I think the module as written did a great job of picking stuff out of the way and unimportant to the grander scheme of, or the grander setting of Forgotten Realms. Like, you know, this, it wasn't a major city. It wasn't like Baldur's Gate.
Right.
Or
right.
Waterdeep.
And there was no mention of it.
That's right.
Was there anything specific in here that you omitted or just didn't get to about, like, gods or...
I think the biggest addition to the setting-wise was mentioning that goblins were not uncommon. If those of you who have followed along, this adventure started with a goblin raid, and like that was kind of the hook to get the adventurers into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So the book made no mention of how frequent goblins are and whatever. So like the goblins had just come into the wood from the hills. Like that's all it said. And so I kind of added in this, like, you know, a classic generic fantasy of like, yeah, those things just exist.
There might be goblins around.
In the wilderness.
It would be weird to run into them.
You know, they hide out in the hills, and they, you know, opportunists take caravans and raid stuff, and, like, they rarely go into town unless, like, they got a big war band going on. So that was all, like, my addition of the setting that I had created, which was just, you know, a generic fantasy setting. It could have been Forgotten Realms. It could have been Warhammer.
I think that's actually some fairly deft game mastering, because what it seems like to me is that giving the players this hook for the start of the adventure, like, oh, goblins came to town and did a thing, and now, you know, go figure out what's up with that. And then you do, and immediately it's like, ah, not goblins, tricked you.
Yeah.
It's frogs. But if you're fighting, like, you could have changed the frogs in this story to goblins and hobgoblins, and I don't feel like it would have mattered, you know? It seemed like a little thing to, like, well, that's classic start for a first-level adventure. Goblins raided the town.
Right.
Go deal with it. And then, oh, I switcherooed you. It's not goblins, it's frogs. But to no meaningful effect. So what you did in the beginning by explaining how, you know, giving us some context for what a goblin raid would, what we would think about a goblin raid.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciated that. And then as the story developed, I was pretty interested in it, because quickly we realized that, like, oh, she did that to try and... The Hamadryad did that to try and, like, get folks to come.
Yeah.
You know. It's more interesting.
I agree. Yeah, and it I think... because I didn't realize you had done that. It, like, brilliantly sort of fit well into, like, the tone of the rest of it, where it kind of was like hooks and mysteries the whole way down, right? Like, we solved one thing, kind of like Cosmo was just saying, only to find out there was, like, more behind that, and now we got to go find the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I felt, like, engaged sort of just by that, like, oh, this is how the world is, this is how the goblins are, and that's weird that they're not behaving that way.
Have a character tell us, like, yeah, that's a thing that happened.
Yeah.
Other characters in town are telling us, like, hey, that's not really how they usually behave. There's a reason why you should go check this out. And then, well, it seemed like there's stats in there to fight the Dryad, right?
Yeah.
So there's every possibility we could have got to the first meeting and gotten in a fight with her.
The way it was written had a contingency of if the players just want to kill whatever comes across their path.
Okay.
So there's stat blocks and exposition, I guess, for if you fought Loreley, if you fought the Naiads, I'm not sure on that one, if you fought the town watchman. If you fought the town watchman in the beginning,
the
there were
enchanted ones.
But if the slaves on the dam, I think those stat blocks were not included. It was just Melina.
Oh, so like the rest of her party.
Oh no, restrained townsguardmen. Here they are.
Oh wow.
But that's just kind of how Dungeons & Dragons have to work, because mm-hmm. unlike the games that we've been playing, you have to run and roll every combatant as if they're a character.
Yeah.
And that's just classic Dungeons & Dragons. Yes. So whether or not we fight them, or whether they fight each other, or fight some of the frogs, you have to have a full stat block in order to run them.
Yeah, which is always something I found odd about Dungeons & Dragons, because it just makes me feel like then, so am I supposed to fight
mm-hmm.
this thing, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's good aligned, right? They use the alignment system. It's good aligned, it's lawful good, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using it as a DM to sort of, like, aid my players or give exposition or whatever. The inclusion of a stat block sort of feels like... but what if you hit it, though? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I think it is, you know, it might as well be included, because
sure.
they know, like, well, you know, there is a non-zero amount of players who will try and hit it.
For sure.
And
for sure.
So that needs to be accounted for in the design.
I think that's an important thing of, like, module writing, is you need to account for that, you know, non-zero percent that wants just to hit it. Because, like, if you're writing, even if, like, it's, you know, for a system more like the ones that we favor, where, like, you kind of just, the game master, two NCPs on the opposite side of a fight, you know, you can just say what happens and you don't need to bog yourself down with a bunch of rolls.
Mm-hmm.
You still need that stat block in case the players, you know, have an itch to kill everything they come across.
Right.
Because then, like, you know, what happens when you guys do that and there is no stat block in the module, and, like, an inexperienced game master could be like, oh, fuck. Well, you know, I don't know. And maybe there's a break in play, maybe, mm-hmm. like, it's unbalanced mm-hmm. or something. You know, kind of just idiot-proofing it, I think that's a good addition in your modules to have.
Yeah, it probably padded the page count of this mm-hmm. a little bit, but, like, well, if you're going to put a character in here, put its stats also, because just in case.
Well, and that's nice, too, because then it doesn't present itself sort of as, like, a railroaded adventure. Like, mm-hmm. you still have these paths, even if they're dead ends, to,
right.
like, explore or, like, potentially go down and change the sort of tone of the adventure, so it's multifaceted in that way.
Right. This isn't like, it's not like Fallout 4, you know, where there are some characters where you just can't attack them.
Right.
You know, it's fully, you know, fully interactive.
And I think it'd be easy to write a module that is Fallout 4, right?
Like, right.
Or to your point.
Yeah, in that vein, where just, like, some things you can and can't do, some characters are only interactive in this one way.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think sort of detracts from what a tabletop role-playing game should be. So, I agree. Like, this did this. This prepared, it seemed like, at least, it prepared itself well in that regard.
Yeah. I also, I would say that is what we were just talking about. Like, having some characters where there can only be one interaction, and it's like, yeah, you talk to them, and that's it. Like, you can't hit them. I think that's also fine.
I think so, too.
I think the problem in, like, a module like this is you might have an inexperienced game master who doesn't know how to handle that situation, and if, like, it's not explicitly said, like, this character, you know, cannot be attacked...
Yeah.
Right, because, like, how do you explain that to a new game master in a text that's easily understandable and everything? It's just hard.
Yeah,
that's true.
Which I guess, you know, goes into I've only surface level skimmed through this module to see the organization and, you know, how stuff flows. There's an interesting mixture of language, and I assume this is true for all adventure modules that are written for other people to use. There's a mixture of, like, flavorful descriptive text, but then, you know, in the same block of text it'll switch to, like, hopefully the players will do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, you know, there's this option, but hopefully it goes this way type of thing. A mixture of you know, evocative fantasy language that you can use to help sell the adventure, as well as like a direct conversation between the author and whoever's going to be running it. You're like, I kind of intended this. Hopefully the players pick up on it. Here's maybe a couple ways that you can scooch them towards that. And if they insist, then this.
God. I think this module did a great balance of that, because it's hard to... So, like, at some points, I was like, oh, like, this should have been in, like, italics, and, like, this is for the players, this is for the game master. but I think that's hard to do throughout the whole thing. I mean, you know, this is a...
It would have been cool if back in the 70s, booklet. Someone had, like, codified that.
Yeah.
And been like, if you write an adventure module, bold means this. Italics means you read it to the players.
You regular hear text that, Gary means, Gygax? You know. Fix your shit.
But, yeah.
He's a Patreon, isn't he?
I get what you're saying. Like, it'd be hard, especially across multiple adventures, over multiple different publications. Mm-hmm. There's... You know, what is the standard way to do that and present that information? It seems like a challenge that, you know, if no one did it back in the beginning, it's never going to be standardized.
Yeah. And I'm going to drop this line later so we can pick it up.
Hell yeah. Put it on the board.
Mothership. Yeah, put it on the board. Okay. So we come back.
So we don't forget when we talk about Mothership.
The Mothership module had a different format that I liked a little bit better than this. It was very clear on like what was
for
what
players.
Could be for the players and what could and is only for the game master. And it's like, here's a little description. Say this.
Mm-hmm. Did you find though in this module, or like as you were like running it, there's a rhythm like to itself?
Yeah, I mean, like, so, like, for this one, the format, like, every new area had some sort of, like, italic little blurb that's, like, I took it as, like, when appropriate. For example, like, when you guys came upon the dam description was written for if you come upon it from the road, but you guys cut through the wood, right, and came around it from a different angle.
Came it from behind.
Right, so that one was a little tough because, like, where you guys were was, like, forward in the book. So I was reading through that and, like, you know, working off of that. And then, like, you come up through the dam. So I have to skim a couple pages back. And then, like, okay, well, here's what the dam looks like. And then I have to change it because of, like, you know, your approach angles. Like, you can't see all of this. You don't get this full, like, italics description. You only get some of it because, you know, just the way that you approached it.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of layout, was that easy enough to know, like, okay, well, if I want to find the dam from the other angle, I just need to find this sort of, like, formatting or whatever further into the book? Or
it did a really good job at, like, everything is, like, written, so, like, area, so, like, for example, the Earthen Dam, which is what I have up right now, it's area 3, right? There's a, like, master map on the back page, which is, you know, super easy to find. You don't have to remember what page it's on. You just, you know, flip to the back cover, boom, there's the map. And all right, the dam, area 3. So, like, you pop to area 3, and it's got a bunch of sub areas.
Okay.
So, I think this map, having a map like this is extremely helpful.
It feels, and I imagine listeners, when you don't have this in front of you, if you're thinking about this, and maybe if you're not super familiar with what, like, an adventure zine looks like, it sounds like it might be kind of convoluted, but since it's not a website with hyperlinks, you know, there is no, you know, like, some things are going to be before or after maybe when they should be in chronological or geographical order according to the map. So having this, like, turn to the back page, there's a key, it tells you what area to go to, and then page back through that. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of the printed version of hyperlinks on a website. I can't think of an easier way to do that, honestly.
Yeah.
On on paper.
That being said, though, I do think there's one critique of the organization. So, like, there's, like, the areas and all this, like, written description and the stat blocks, but there's these, like, what are these called?
Text boxes.
Like text boxes, call-outs of stuff. And those are kind of harder to organize. And, like, there are several times in the adventure where it's like, I know I've read this thing, but I can't remember exactly how it's supposed to go.
Mm.
Let me try to find it real quick. And then there's a long pause. And then, you know, we have our ad break for beer. It's good.
Still is.
So, like...
Continues to be.
Yeah. How about that?
If I was writing this, I would put some sort of, you know, real text hyperlink, so it's not actually a hyperlink, but it would be like, you know, see text box this on this page.
Whenever it's referenced elsewhere.
Right, yeah, because, like, so, for example, when we were, when you were assaulting the oak tree, like, here's the page for, like, the middle platform and everything. This unexpected aid, this is a text box for, like, when you guys are approaching the tree.
Yeah.
And, like, assaulting the tree. Supposedly, you know, Coralie, where she died, which was outside the tree, when a player ran by it, they were supposed to hear this faint, melodious whisper, "Trust me, my ally, and the Briars will be your friend." That hero can now pass through the Briars as if they were not there, right? But that's on this page, where the Briar, like, approach is on the page before. Yeah,
the text block that describes the obstacle and how it affects players that move through it is not, like, that should have been...
You haven't read it
That yet. Should have been a bullet underneath that same text block.
Right, because, like, I knew that Melina was supposed to move through the Briars. You know, she had a special bond with the Fae Sisters, et cetera, et cetera.
But it's separated because it's a point of interest.
Mm-hmm. And it's on the following page, right?
Yeah.
So, like, page 14, you're talking about, like, you know, whatever the encounter, and then page 15 is that call out explaining more about it. So I could see how that's confusing, because I would, if I had thought I had already read it, I would be going backwards in the book.
Right, which is what I was doing. Right. And then, like, there was that big pause there.
Are there, just as we're looking through this, so each encounter, does each encounter have repeat stat blocks for, like, Frogfolk Warriors and stuff? Or do you have to go to a master page for Frogfolk Warrior?
That's a good question.
That is a good question, and it is repeated. So, okay. Like...
I think that's good. That probably pads the page count a little bit, but it's, you know, as if you were going through a video game, you know, there would just be another instance of the enemy in that place with its own, you know, duplicate stats. And I think having them there, because I see what you've been doing, keeping tally marks for hit points and stuff like that, you can just do that on the ones on that page.
Yeah.
This page describes this encounter, and here are the stat blocks for this encounter, and they're duplicated. You know, you'll find the same stat block for the same frog warrior several other places in the book, but this one's here next to the other stuff you need to reference for this encounter. That seems well organized.
You brought up padding the pages a couple times. Is that important?
I don't think so. I think, I don't think making it longer is important, but I think hitting a maximum page count for zines like this probably is very important.
So you don't want to go over a certain amount. Okay.
I personally prefer the other way. I would like a master... I usually game master with, like, a master sheet of all the, like, enemies and the NPC stat blocks all in a row.
I do as well.
As, like, a separate sheet. And so, like, in the text, it would just be like, yeah, there are four frog folk warriors, reference frog folk warrior stat block. And just, like, you know, have a page in the back where it's just like, here are the enemies. Here's a frogfolk warrior. Here's a frogfolk taskmaster. Here's a poison dart frog. Here's, you know, the frog wizard, Gruanok.
That's how I game master as well, with just like, these are all the bad guys on a little sheet, and then I have my other notes. But I see the value of having the stat blocks duplicated and just printed under the header of whatever encounter they're a part of.
I've stopped DMing that way, actually.
Like the way that we both said?
Yeah, because I used to, like, for 8 years or whatever, that's how I used to do it. And I find I'm much more organized, but I'm writing more now.
Mm.
So as I write more, I like to have the details of everything I'm doing under that one header. Mm. It's still bullet points, and, like, it's not a novel or whatever.
Yeah.
But I like there to be, like, and I use a digital program to do it, so I can hover over the name of a monster, and then the stat block comes up.
That's cool.
But still,
and that's that would if this was digital, you wouldn't have to. You could just, like, hover over, and it would
exactly it which eats less space, yeah. Right? So literally everything in that encounter is on the page in front of me,
right?
But I've found it keeps me more organized, sort of in the instance or tavern or whatever it is I'm in. It keeps me more organized with that, and I can just sort of be present and extra, like, organized with that event, rather than sort of like, oh yeah, this is coming up, and, like, as I'm, like, kind of shuffling back and forth between papers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm trying to take better notes too, and I find if I'm just on one piece of paper or one screen, it it helps with my note taking. And I noticed you, Dane, had already kind of, like, pre-filled in some, like, little notes and stuff on each of these pages, and I feel like I would have done the same thing, and I feel like, again, having that stat block there.
Mm.
I know that I wouldn't have.
That was mostly...
But you probably should have.
To port the stats from 5e into Medium Dungeon.
Mm.
So, like, I went through and, like, underlined stuff, like, you know, this DC of 14, well, in Medium Dungeon, it's going to be a 12, right? And this damage dice here is going to be, you know, a 1d4 in Medium Dungeon.
Mm.
So that's kind of, that was, like, my prep work, and I, like, you know, slash some bonuses and change the, like, you know, proficiency or the bonus to the roll for enemies and their health, just to balance it out more for a Medium Dungeon than 5e.
Would you have done as much, like, sort of, like, would you have, like, read through the whole thing? And because even, like, the ones you didn't annotate, you still were aware, like, oh, I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what, did you fine-tooth comb this before you ran it? Or also, am I getting ahead?
No, you're not getting ahead. I did, I wouldn't say fine-tooth combed it, but when we did most of it that night, I had taken off a little bit of work to prepare, because, like, I hadn't prepared before. Like, I hadn't even read the fucking first page of the module. So, like, I blocked off a couple hours to read through the module, and I, you know, tried to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and then, like, you know, just a little bit of prep work just to make sure I could faithfully run the module, rather than, you know, if I had prepped something for that, for the episodes, or, you know, if we were doing an adventure through my creation, if I was just ripping a, you know, an RPG light or a one shot, and it's like, oh, we're going to use Medium Dungeon, I got to come up with everything, I definitely would have done less work.
Hmm.
I was just trying to.
Speaking of the first page, just looking at this, I really like how this, on the very first page, lays out everything.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
does it?
There is no mystery for the Game Master.
Okay.
Like, as the Game Master, you open this and you read this first page and you know everything. It tells you, like, what the Hamadryad's deals are, who the bad guys are, what they're doing, who knows what about what's going on. And then at the end here, the last ditch effort, Lorelei sends a charmed guard back to Burr Hollow, and that is the start of the adventure.
Mm.
And then you turn the page and there's the, you know, descriptive stuff about the starting town. It tells you without any, like, it's not like as a game master you have to read the whole thing to understand what's going on and know what kind of thing you're going to be guiding your players through. It is all laid out start to finish in the start of the booklet. And I think that's pretty critical because you're not writing a novel. You're not hiding any of this information to be like, you know, excitedly discovered later. You're telling the Game Master everything they need to know so that then they can do that for the players.
Right. And so like if they get lost in the sauce, you know, midway through a combat, they can, you know, work their way out of it and be like, okay, well, like, I'm kind of lost in the pages here. I don't know exactly what's next, but, like, I have a general idea of what's next, so we can just rip on.
Mm-hmm. Which is how I think, because I'm selfishly, I'm working on starting up a campaign using a module to sort of, like, be a launching pad. But what I've done is sort of take that first page, know what the beats are, and then just kind of, like, go with it. Would you have done the same? Were you not sort of, like, trying to have the full module experience for this? Or do you think it's beneficial to sort of, you know, as much prep work as you did going
into it? No, so if I was running something from my own mind, basically what I would have done is this first page.
Yeah.
And that's it. And, like, you know, had some ideas of, like, oh, okay. You know, so, like, I'm curious to see how you guys are going to, you know, work out this problem. I don't know exactly what the checks are going to be or what the difficulty of those checks are going to be, but, like, I know there's going to be a check around here.
Yeah.
So basically just, yeah, a rough outline. It definitely wouldn't have been this wordy, right, because it's all in my mind, so, like, I don't need to write it down. So it'd just be, like, a list of bullet points of, you know, here's the situation. Here's everything about the situation. Here's all the context. Let the players cook.
It seems to be like other modules and stuff I've read. I've only run a few. That's kind of the balance it seems like they're always trying to keep is like they have to make it wordy, at least up front, to kind of garner your interest as the DM who's like potentially thinking about running it. At the sacrifice of sort of like the ease of like what would like a, this would be much better served with just like a bullet list, right? Of like, you know, a charm guard comes back, you learn about the dryad or the goblins, you go or whatever, right? Like you go to the help the dryad tells you this. So I think, and kind of back to what we were talking about before, like it all sort of rolls into this idea of like, you don't know the experience of the player, or I'm sorry, the DM, GM who's running it. So you sort of have to cater to like the birth of like, it's a brand new DM who's going to be running this, so they need all the hand holding the whole way through, and that might be sort of cumbersome for an experienced, you know, two-headed game master who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, but you've got to write it. Like, you can't write less.
Right.
Is basically what you're saying, right?
Like, I think you can. It just, then you start sacrificing the other way, right?
Yeah.
And so it seems like, at least the modules that I've thumbed through, err on the side of, like, enticing a GM who sort of wants the work done for them. And I know you guys are considering or have sort of, like, chipped away some at modules, like, in your own experience writing them, is it, you know, kind of what's the, it's got to be difficult to sort of anticipate those needs, right?
Yeah, I think that's what I would say my experience is. When you release a module and, you know, give it into somebody else's hands, they have some block with making it up, like filling in the gaps. They're always like, okay, there should be an answer to this somewhere, and if there's not, then I'm going to spend a lot of time looking for an answer isn't there.
And it becomes,
How do I move forward? I don't know.
The emergency brake is on. You know, don't know how that happened. And instead of, and different, you know, different levels of experience, game masters probably respond to this differently. But what you're saying, if there isn't an answer to the thing and if something's not immediately clear, and, you know, they thumb back and forth a couple of pages and they don't see the answer, it does seem like that a game master who is running something that someone else wrote will, you know, be a little afraid to get it wrong.
Right.
Be a little nervous about, like, oh, well, if I do the wrong thing, is this going to break it? Because, you know, you're like the CPU running, you're like the compiler running some code that someone else gave you.
Right.
And if you go off script, there is probably, there's this idea that, like, if you go off script, you'll break it.
You can't ever get back on script.
Yeah.
And you might ruin it. So, yeah, you'll throw the emergency brake and stop playing in order to find the right answer. So, yeah, clarity in writing for someone else to run, clarity is super important, and organization is super important.
To keep that momentum and flow going so it doesn't...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think also, put it on the board...
Drink.
The one-shot mindset is extremely different than a campaign mindset.
Yeah.
And maybe we should revisit one-shots with that focus. Because, like, what you guys could have done is taken advantage of the town watch being gone and, like, you know, fucked with the town.
Yeah. We could have been like, oh. But I saw that page. There's not much there.
Yeah.
That would have forced you to improvise a lot and throw away basically the rest of the thing. And then, yeah, we're like, oh, well, there's no one guarding this town. Let's rob everybody.
That also feels like a violation, though, of, like, sort of what we all sat down. Like, we didn't say.
Right, right. Well, that's what I mean. That one-shot mindset of, like, there is a mystery and adventure to unravel and go on.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to if this was, like, the second thing that you did in a campaign, your players might be like, eh, you know, we're not sure we're interested in this, but, like, maybe something I was doing before has led me to this idea that, you know, I want to rob the, you know, I want to rob the tavern. And
yeah.
I'm more interested in that than I am in engaging with this. Yeah, the sort of unspoken agreement that, like, you know, we're not going to test the boundaries of what this game system can handle, because the game system can handle anything. We kind of tacitly agree that we're going to engage in good faith with what is presented to us.
Right.
Which is a quest.
Yeah, but that's not always the case in a campaign, right?
Yeah.
Have you guys ran a pre-written or, like, a modulized
campaign?
Campaign?
No.
Mm-hmm. Curse of Strahd or something like that?
No.
This is
probably the closest to that, because we stretched this out. Well, I don't know.
This was like an adventure, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, I guess it's...
Well, we did it in two sittings.
Well, yeah, so, like, the nomenclature... Is that the right word? The terminology in Two-Headed Game Master is, like, there's a session. An adventure is made up of one session or several sessions.
Right.
A campaign is made up of several adventures.
I love that definition. It's so good.
That are, yeah.
What a great podcast, arcs. You guys. Fucking love it here.
And I could see this, you know, this module could be a single session, be a long one, but also maybe a different party wouldn't have engaged with everything.
But it's also sectioned.
Yeah.
Nicely, that it lends itself, I think, to, you could do it in a couple sessions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, there are clear breaking points where, like, you finish a combat and get your reward and XP, and
that's a feels good, like, time a nice... to, like, level up and camp.
Yeah.
And naturally break for the session.
Yeah. So to me, I know we did it in a session and a half or whatever, but it felt like it could have been sort of like a drawn-out adventure. Not drawn-out, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it could have, without feeling boring or, like, overextended, been, like, a several-session kind of thing.
And they only really said it once at the end there when you guys were in the tunnels. But it did specifically say for the, like, in-game in the tunnels under the oak tree of, like, you can add in some stuff. You know, you can fill out that thing. There's, like, a, you know, a whole tunnel system there, and I kind of fucked with you guys around with the, you know, the different branches of the tunnel.
That was very good.
You know, as you can see on the map, like, they're all dead ends.
Yeah, there's one path there.
I'm seeing one that leads to a naked bartender.
Yeah.
One over here says gold question
bunch
mark.
Of treasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You so suck, yeah, man. You could any game master could put anything they wanted into these you know, into these twists, but you know, since there's nothing specifically.
Right. Is there a table in there for that?
No.
Okay.
But it is, it's a perfect little just like open plug for you to plug in a table if you...
Yeah, and I feel like that's sort of like, because I think it would be really easy to, as a game master with experience, take this and pick it apart and just be like, well, this and flipping back and forth and like whatever, whatever. And I agree, Dane, like if you're a new DM, like that's a lot of shit. But I think as a, like someone who kind of knows what they're doing or knows what they want to be doing, it's just a tool chest of like, okay, I got an opportunity here to plug in some things. I got, like, you know, I don't have a table, but I have some ideas of, like, monsters I want to fight or, like, a switchback that might, like, be a puzzle or something like that, right? It just seems like the people who kind of get lost in this are the, like, the middle of the road DMs who are, like, they're not brand new, so don't necessarily need, like, the word-for-word, like, hand-holding.
Like, I know the rules of the game.
Yeah, yeah.
But they haven't started thinking like a designer
yet. Or they just don't feel comfortable sort of going off script, right?
Yeah.
That seems like the folks who might have a harder time with this. How did it feel, Cosmo, like being a player? Like, did you, like, because you've obviously, like, played games that Dane ran before.
Yeah.
Did it feel, like, was there a noticeable difference?
Did my styles maintain consistency?
It felt like the same style. It felt like Dane's style.
I agree.
There was, obviously, we're sitting at the same table, so I can see when you, like, turn the page back or forth to check something.
But which I judged.
There's not a lot of difference between that and looking at your notes that you prepared, that you wrote yourself.
That's right.
For an adventure that you bring. So,
I agree.
As far as your game master ability to deliver something that someone else wrote, I never felt like the I never felt a, you know, a juddering. No frame rate drops.
Yeah. I'd say there were just a few times where, like, the tone, I don't know, shifted or halted or whatever, of like, okay, Dane's stopping Dane stuff to make sure he hits this point.
Sometimes you read a specific thing.
But not even even like the reading. You know? I really liked the reading. In fact, one thing I was going to make sure to make a point to say was like the gift of having a written ending and how I struggle with that.
That's nice. And we didn't talk about that at all in our landing the plane episode because that's not something we'd ever fucked with before. But I kind of love that because at the end of a session, especially at the end of a one shot, you can like, well, when do we stop?
That's right.
When do we kind of, when do we put a lid on this?
You guys did talk about that. Yeah. You guys did talk about that.
Yeah. We did.
But we didn't have this tool because I hadn't thought about this before to have just like, oh, at the end of the book, here is a wrap up with a couple of different, and you know, speaking into the future again about Mothership, the module for that. There's, you know, what did you accomplish? Here's a written ending.
Yeah.
Cool. And now, like, it's over. And with a little hook about, you know, but who sent the frog folk? If you want to come back and keep playing, there's probably another zine that, you know, takes a party of level 3 adventurers on the next stage of the journey.
But it also felt conclusive, like that there was really a nice sort of like wrap up with like the seed being planted and the tree growing and like,
the villagers are happy and we're back there, which is a good place to set out on the next thing.
I felt like I had made a difference and would be fine walking away from the adventure, never coming back to it. But yeah, I agree with you totally. Like, it'd be great to like also pick it up and see where it goes next.
I think that's a put it on the board is in a module written for someone else, a written ending, that's a pretty powerful thing.
Because
once you get to that, then that difficulty of like, how do I end this? Or like, when do we actually stop role playing? And when do we say, you did it? It's there.
Yeah.
Fulfill this criteria, you get to this.
Yeah. And it's like you guys talk about it, landing the plane, like that video game kind of cutscene, whatever, but
there's a clear like delineation, yes, of when you cut to it.
That's right. And it does, it's not interrupting the action or like in place of the action. It's sort of like a, you know, culmination of everything you've done.
Right.
Which felt really good about this. But I brought that up because I was talking about how like I could feel the shift from Dane doing Dane to Dane making sure he was hitting the points in, mm-hmm, the book. And not in any sort of negative way.
Mm.
I don't know, was that jarring for you to run?
Not really. It was... I was just trying to do it as faithfully to the book so, you know, we could get a... what's the word? The best review possible. So like
that's kind of what
know,
I was
my,
thinking.
My game
you...
master's, you know, because yeah, like
sure,
I can fuck, right? So
yes, you can.
Like, you know, when I caught myself just going off and being like, you know, here's what I would do. Here's what sounds good. Here's something that's cool.
Yeah.
Be like, wait a second. Is that going to be, you know, is that in line with the book? Because then, like, you know, I would, I didn't want to just completely go off script because then it's not a good review because then you're just reviewing how good am I at, you know, improvising.
And that, so, you know, when you did that, when you reined yourself in and you're like, hang on, let me check, and then, you know, went to consult something and make sure you were actually doing what the book said it was, I didn't find that jarring as a player.
No.
For you to do that as a game master, because I knew that when we sat down and, you know, agreed to engage with this module on its terms, part of the point of that was to, you know, hit all of its beats the way they were written.
That's
so
right.
That we could do this episode where we review it authentically.
Yeah. And even knowing sort of that's what you were doing, it still felt, to your credit, fairly fluid and had your voice throughout of it, you know, mm-hmm, even though you were doing somebody else's work, which was very good, Dane.
Thank you. So, like, the biggest thing, like, the biggest whiplash, I guess, was, for me, like, reading the book and then, like, you know, getting in the flow of my own game mastering, was the ogre runts. Because there is somewhere in the book about, like, Grunkle's whole deal is, like, they're being paid, ? By the frog folk. So, like, they're not really... They're not, like, working for the wizard of, like, yeah, I believe in its cause. Like, they're getting paid, so, like, you can talk them down.
Okay.
But then we couldn't.
Just, like, how the...
Because we set him on fire.
Well, yeah, but, like, also just, like, I just didn't understand how that was going to play at all.
There's maybe some stuff, because I could see that... Well, I see that working basically how it worked for us when you consider Dungeons & Dragons, but then... So earlier mentioned how much I enjoy Warhammer Fantasy as a setting. And in Warhammer Fantasy, there's a specific thing about ogres is that that is kind of their culture. And so if we had bought into this more specifically as a, you know, specifically... Forgotten Realms, mm-hmm, or specifically, mm-hmm, Warhammer Fantasy, is like in Warhammer Fantasy there's lots of ogres in hanging out with regular folks and they're always in the role of like hirelings and mercenaries.
Mm.
So if you see an ogre in Warhammer, it's going to be a tough fight, but you could probably pay them off, and that's just a thing about those characters in that setting. That's not necessarily a given about any of these, and also I don't know anything about frog folks versus, and I'll reiterate that I don't think there's a lot of difference between frog folks and goblins.
Whoa.
In terms of how we interacted with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
or how they behaved. Like, I could see an evil goblin shaman doing this exact same thing, and we would just fight some goblins.
That's right.
Versus frog folk.
That's right.
So, yeah, it just, to us, seemed like another monster.
That's a good point, because there was also the moment when you guys first were parlaying with Loralee that you, Brian, were like, she's offering us a deal, but hold on, she's fae, so, like, right, you know, let's do a little quick think. Like,
let's think about, one, like, us as players, fae stuff. What do we know about the fae, and also what would our characters know about interacting with the fae?
Because they're okey-doke masters, in my understanding of them, where they, you know, they're like, hey, I didn't catch your name. Can I have your name?
And then
you
and give like, them their name. Don't fucking say it.
And then they steal your name, and now your name's gone forever, right? Mm-hmm. So...
and you can't eat or drink anything they give you.
Right,
that's
right.
That's bad.
Right, so that was my sort of...
But they also can't
Is that
lie.
Why you guys didn't do the potions?
No, that's...
I kept looking
that's
at
the
it like...
thing that I forgot
That's
about.
Going to be real helpful. I'm going to save that. And I still might use it, Dane. I don't know, dude. That bark... plus two bark skin, man.
But, yeah, so... I guess everything that I said in the beginning about how, like, it's just generic classic fantasy and it was able to just be that in a vacuum, basically. Mm-hmm. Yes, but there were some moments like that where, like, well, we need to nail down some stuff about Fae right now. Because there's, you know, commonly held mythology stuff versus, like, official D&D stuff versus other fantasy setting stuff about Fae or ogres or different fantasy creatures.
I think that works extremely well, though, in making it, one, a generic and accessible setting, and two, like, in terms of role-playing, because even though, like, you know, you as the player are like, hold on, I know there's, like, some, you know, questions.
Yeah, there's some stuff about Fae we should maybe ask.
You know, questions we should be asking. But that also plays in just the role-playing. It's like, your characters have probably heard rumors and stories. And so, like, who the fuck knows what is actually real? But, like, you know, it goes through your mind to be like, wait a second, is this a trick? Like, what's the angle here?
Yeah.
What do we know? What's false? What's true? So I think that's just something about fantasy that I really like. The setting of fantasy of it's make-believe, and there's so many different types. It's like, are these the type of vampires that, like, you know, hate garlic? Or is that just, like, a stupid myth that people tell each other?
Right.
Like, where did that come from? Is that real?
You
know,
and
I
can
try
play
it.
With it, right?
Right, yeah. And, like, you know, oh, these vampires, they love garlic. They think it's an hilarious rumor that they started to flavor human blood. Like, so they like it.
Yeah.
Right? But, that's like, good. They also won't enter a house unless, you know, invited in. Right, and so, like,
because they're polite.
You can pick and choose and, like, fuck with the players on, like, you know, in my fantasy world, this is the truth, but I'm not going to tell the players that. I'm going to let them, you know, agonize over it.
Is it possible, like, when writing a module like this, or anyone in general, that you also have to kind of plan for contingencies where you have a party of players who's the opposite of kind of what we've already addressed, where, like, so in the beginning we talked about how you might have a party who wants to kill everything.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also those parties that exist that want to talk to everyone.
I think there's a contingency there that is fairly simple. It's just that, like, some creatures will attack you. And they're
bad guys are bad guys.
Yeah, some creatures will not engage. And, like, maybe you'll get one of them, you know, if we just, like, got one frog on his own and been like, hey, dude, what's going on? We could have maybe been talking with him, but as soon as his friends saw what was going on, they had attacked us. And if you refuse to fight, then you just die and fail the adventure. And that is an acceptable ending, is mission failure.
But as a baby DM, which again, you kind of have to think about when you're writing.
Right.
I think back to, like, the ogre, like, riding an ogre in for no other reason other than to have an NPC monster who sort of has that out to kind of show, like, hey, here's an opportunity where you could sort of, you know, guide your players into, like, this kind of interaction, or, you know, if it's a new party, new DM, you've sort of, as an author of a module, given them some framework for, like, what that interaction could look like, right? So I don't know, you know, that I think we kind of knew the score going in of like, this is a big, this is going to be a big problem if we let it become a big problem.
Yeah.
So we're just going to burn it
with
fire. So we
put a stop to that immediately.
Right.
And in doing so, we shut a door that we didn't really know was there.
That's right. And I wonder if, like, I don't know, Dan, you might know better, like going in the front, if we have an opportunity to talk to that ogre at some point.
Well, so what's written down is, well, so first, if you approach it from the front, like the taskmaster, or, well, the overseer? No, taskmaster. Sees you, one, you know, sends one frog to light the beacon, and then sends one frog to the camp to rouse the ogre. And it's like, you know, if that frog is allowed to escape to the camp, he'll rouse the ogre in, like, D4 turns or something like that. So from the front, you could kill the frogs on the dam, and then the ogre is still sleeping. If the, and then it says, so like, quote text, a coward at heart, a DC 13 charisma intimidation check after the taskmaster is slain is enough to convince Grunkle to surrender.
Okay.
If convinced or charmed to breach the dam, he can complete this task in 2 hours. If allowed to flee, he will leave the area and seek another employer. So there's conditions on that. So you can't just do what you guys did, is stumble upon the ogre and be like, psst, hey, you want to fight for us?
Yeah, here's a five spot. Yeah.
But so like, I just didn't see how that one makes a bunch of sense, because if you're in the middle of a combat,
yeah,
most players will identify the ogre as a giant threat.
I see what you're saying.
Right, and would have attacked it previously. So like, oh, the ogre's been, you know, shot with a sling a couple times, and then all of a sudden the taskmaster dies, so he's like willing to parlay? Probably not. He's probably angry and a little pissed off.
He's probably mad about that instead, regardless of whether that guy's dead. Mm.
Yeah, but what if it's like a, instead of a, like a visible threat, it's like a different race other than a frog, but it's like a sapper or something, right? And so now we don't feel immediately threatened by it,
mm-hmm.
so we're willing to sort of like slow down and be like, well, yeah, wait a minute, this guy might have explosives, maybe we can talk him,
like,
off
of it's him. It's a good idea, I think, to put that wrinkle in a big encounter and be like, you might not have to fight
everything.
This guy,
yeah,
or this couple of guys,
mm-hmm. especially a big guy, which could be
by telling him that they're different somehow.
Yeah,
right. And like, I can see, like, so like, you know, picture this one, right? So like, you get to the dam, the front of the dam, that stuff happens, the frog runs to the camp to rouse the ogre. Meanwhile, like, he gets away. Maybe you know, throw a spear, shoot an arrow at him. He gets away. You kill all the frogs of the dam, including the taskmaster.
Mm-hmm.
The like, frog who went to rouse him and Grunkle come back, see their buddy's dead, and you guys are, you know, four, you know, five of you are sitting there, and, you know, maybe however many humans survive are sitting there looking up at this dam and be like, okay, well, how do we destroy this?
Mm.
Then lone frog and ogre come in and be like, you know, the ogre's like, oh, everybody dead?
Yeah. And then the frog's like, get him, get him, get him. And he's like, the ogre's like,
the ogre scratches his head.
It's
like, I don't know.
Yeah.
How am I going to get paid? Are you going to pay me? You know, and then like, ooh, opening for the players.
Oh, hey, I got some gold.
Yeah.
Break the dam for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that... Do you play test these if you write them? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, I would imagine you had to.
So I don't know.
But I also imagine that not very much. Like, not enough to... Not like a video game.
Sure.
You know, where...
No, of course.
Where, like, a QA team stress tests it.
Yeah.
I imagine you maybe, you know, run it once or twice for your friends and then turn your notes, you know, polish up your notes.
That's why on this one, in section 2A, there's a wall you can actually just push into, and if you do a double jump, you just go right to the dryad at the end.
Oh, you mean 2A, the mosquitoes?
That's what I said. There's a wall next to the mosquitoes. No, but I asked because I wonder if, like, played enough, or at least, like, once or twice, do you sort of, like, and as you guys are, like, writing yours... Mm. Do you sort of flesh out some of those, like, oh, okay, this shouldn't be an ogre should be a smaller guy, or the ogre should show up
in
later,
a different way.
Yeah, so they don't feel so threatening, and now I've created more of an... I've sort of achieved what I was trying to do, but I only found that out through sort of, like, testing or whatever.
I mean, I've never gotten that far.
Yet.
You know, with something like this.
I would say if this is, like, published through a publisher, it had to be play-tested at some point. There's no way that Chris Doyle just submitted this and was like, yep, good, mint it, print it, sell it.
I actually think that's probably pretty likely for a lot of adventure modules that do get published. And I honestly don't even believe that the Wizards of the Coast team playtests everything they publish in the official D&D books. I think maybe it gets one or two passes.
Is there a playtester?
Are there playtesters listed?
Pete Bell, Mark Kellenberger, David Key, Kalel Zakiram Key, and Jack Simonson.
Jack, what are you doing?
All missed the opportunity to fix that ogre bug. No.
Playtesters. But it doesn't say how many times they playtested.
Yeah, and that's and enough under people what conditions, for a party, you know, a run-through.
Yeah. So, you know. My guess is a lot of this stuff gets maybe one playtest, if that.
Dude, this is completely just jumping forward. Do you run this again, Dane?
Interesting.
Like, is there enough value in this? Now you're off the hook.
Yeah.
You're not making a podcast to, like, review it.
Mm-hmm.
New party.
This is good.
And you don't have anything necessarily prepared, but you know you've...
You can whip this out.
You've got this in your back pocket. Like, is it a well you go back to?
I think it is. I think I'm going to put it in my well. The details will change. The setting probably would change, right? Because we don't do a lot of, like, 5e.
Right.
We barely do, like, generic fantasy.
Sure.
You know, right now I'm doing as much Afterlife stuff as I can.
Right.
Afterlife, 2HGM's original role-playing setting and mechanics.
That's
available now on DriveThruRPG. But the story structure, I think, is
good
enough to replay, and I'm just going to straight up steal it. The idea of
the
fey folk, you know, needing help, and they kind of go about it the wrong way, and they're like, well, you know, how else am I going to get help?
Yeah.
I know. You know, send some bad guys, attack the town as, like, a feint to, like, you know, draw them in, and then they're going to solve my problem.
Right.
The structure of it, too, of just, like, they're all fairly interesting encounters, even the ones that are only combat. They had some sort of, like, environmental hazard. They had some, you know, the tree with the platforms. There's an elevation thing with, like, an obstacle around the tree.
That's right.
It wasn't just like, oh, you're next to a tree and there's this many frogmen to fight. And that is, we haven't talked about it much, and I don't want to talk about it a lot, but I don't enjoy the combat in Dungeons & Dragons.
No, same.
All of these encounters had something going on. And, you know, like when we found the River Naiads, there's a basket of interesting encounters that, you know, as you're traveling through the woods, you'll come across some, if not all of them, and different parties and different players will interact with them differently.
Have you guys ever had the opportunity to rerun something?
We've done a couple, but never, like, rigorously testing.
No, I didn't mean from a testing standpoint.
But we have rerun some stuff. Dane wrote a cool Torg adventure about raiding a temple.
Yeah.
That I played in one, and then same weekend you ran another version of it, right? Or was it...
The next week. Or whatever.
With...
Different players.
Different players, but the same thing. And then a while ago, I had an Afterlife one-shot that we... we ran at the same time. So, like, I wrote most of it and then went through it with Dane. And then we each ran separate versions of it simultaneously to small parties and then chatted about how it went and what.
And that one was the actual, like, module that, like, then Cosmo gave to a friend to run.
And he couldn't really get past
it. Like, I didn't know how to do this. Yeah. And, like, you know, I got stuck here.
Interesting.
But then also rerunning stuff is I did a... I mean, you actually were part of that. The, what did I call it? Like, Alpha Serum 8 or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
or,
yeah.
Like, Baby Christmas.
It was during COVID. Yep. And I was playing... So I was playing in the version you were in,
right.
And I was also playing in a parallel version of that same quest with a different party.
I think, though, like, and I don't know, did you experience, because I think this is a benefit of modules just generally, or a well-written sort of like self-creation is, the second time you run them or the third or whatever, you kind of know where those like catches are.
Mm-hmm.
And so you run them better the second time, and it's even easier, in my experience at least, the second time. To me, that's like an appeal of modules. If like, if you're somebody who's lucky enough to have like multiple groups who like are willing to play with you, right? I don't know a world though where you have the module, you have one group.
Not unless it's your job.
Yeah. But, like, why do you play a module again, right?
So right.
That's the other thing is, like, if you're paying money for it.
And that's, yeah, that's why I kind of don't believe this got playtested more than once with that one party of playtesters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a player, if I wasn't interested in the design and I wasn't thinking about designing and writing my own stuff, I'd be like, oh, we're just playing this again.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if the hater... You know, imagine if you told him we were just going to do it again.
Do it again.
This next weekend.
From the top.
We're going to run it back. Reset everybody to one.
Well, I'd do this with you again, Dane.
Aw, thanks, babe.
You, Cosmo, though? No fucking way.
Well, I'll roll better. I'll do a
different
character. I'll do a different character, and they'll fucking hit some rolls.
I loved your character.
Actually, I did,
too. We didn't
get
to talk about the actual, like, playing and stuff. I loved your character.
I liked all of our characters a lot. You know, classic fantasy, but also just having fun with it.
Yeah.
Shall we, closing thoughts?
Let's closing thoughts on this.
I feel like it was fun to play, because I felt like, there was a sense of direction the whole time. It felt very, cohesive and it was fun. And I thought like, just as like an individual module, it was well written enough as an adventure that I enjoyed just the adventure itself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sold on modules as like a DM, but I'm curious to sort of, this has made me curious to like kind of explore them more.
I agree with just like, it was written well enough and you know, you handled it good. So
yeah.
I had a good time playing.
Yeah.
It's fairly simple, just, you know, something's wrong, go into the woods and, you know, hit it with your sword for the most part. But there was interesting stuff to talk to and, mm-hmm. you know, some wrinkles, and there was stuff to find. There's things about it being specifically for Dungeons & Dragons that I don't care about, like, oh, we got gold rewards. Okay. I stopped noting, like, the gold value of the loot we were getting.
At the end, I was writing down the gold. I looked over, and you were just, like, looking off in the space.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, right, because we're not using it. Right.
Don't care about
right,
that.
Right, right, right.
Like you said, I'm not necessarily sold on the idea of using modules myself as a game master. But that's more because, you know, we play a lot of original stuff, and we don't really,
same.
You know, muck about in the 5e space especially. But I'm it's kind of like it's rekindled an interest that I had in like figuring out how to write good modules and, you know, what to include and what to repeat. And I feel like this is a pretty good example. And mm-hmm. playing through it and then looking through the book a little bit afterwards, I feel like I've learned some stuff, and this is a good example of how to write something that someone else can use.
Yeah.
As the game master, I liked the...
Stop rolling so good.
why don't you guys just get good beforehand? I liked the general flow and stakes of the adventure, where it starts out really small mm-hmm. and kind of builds. Mm-hmm. There's still a clear like direction and focus, like, you know, the encounters all led to this one problem, right? That's like right. The mosquitoes wouldn't have been there if the river was at full flow.
Yeah.
The naiads yeah. wouldn't have been in trouble without you know, the dam.
That's right.
Like, so it all kind of funnels you without feeling like a just like walk through the forest unmolested and go fight the frogs. It was like seeing the devastation and being, you know, right. building up that like, all right, this is what we're fighting
That's
for.
That's a good point.
There was like three points where we technically had accomplished an objective and we could have gone home.
Yeah.
But every time we got to that point,
there was something more.
It also right? raised the stakes, and yes. there was a reason to keep going.
So no,
was,
you're right. That was That's, well done. You're right. That's very good.
So I think that was very well done. The other thought I had, which I forgot, was something about the... it was on the same line, like the travel there, like it was focused in all the same problem and wasn't just like, ooh, bandits attack you.
Yeah.
It was just
no random encounters.
It was cohesive.
That make no sense.
It was cohesive. Yeah. That was my second point, was in addition to like always raising the stakes and pointing you to, you know, the next thing very well, it also was cohesive. And it never felt just like, you know, oh, fucking bandits and like, oh, we're, you know, ambushed at night and like all this, you know, extra shit right. where it just kind of makes it miserable and be
That's
like
right.
you know. And it also doesn't do the other thing where it's like, yep, we meet Lorelei in the morning and we're at the dam by the afternoon.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
There was enough space in between to make it feel like a journey and an actual adventure.
Yeah, I agree. Well said.
Well, that was the Fae Sisters' Fate. If you like what you hear, head on over to 2hgm.com, and the first thing you'll see, as mentioned before, is a pop-up ad for Afterlife, our original post-apocalyptic fantasy role-playing game and setting, available on DriveThruRPG. So check that out. It's pretty cool.
Very fun.
You'll also see the link to our Patreon. If you become a patron, you get access to the Discord, where we do live events like the Fae Sisters Fates. You can follow along live on Discord and chat us and goof with us and, you know, peanut gallery it.
Think we're that we're woodland creatures. That
yeah.
could be something you do.
That could be something you do.
It's also the path to participating in an episode.
Yeah.
You
might get
being
picked.
A player in an adventure and stuff like that. Or guesting if you got something you want to talk about, because, you know, sometimes we're hard up for episode ideas. So
and
if you got something you want to talk about,
also
tell us.
On that vein, you don't have to be a patron to get that. If you, you know, have an idea
yeah.
and have something to talk about,
just shoot us an email.
Shoot us an email.
Like you guys said on the Land It episode, like we'll do whatever you tell us.
Yeah.
Yeah. If anyone came in and was like, hey, do this for an episode, we'd probably try it. Because otherwise we'd have to come up with an episode ourselves.
Yeah, and that's... They should be modules for episodes. All right, that's been my time, you guys.
All right.
Thanks for coming
on. Yeah, thanks for
I love this
again,
fucking
Brian.
Show, dude.
I'm sure we'll have you back.
I hope so. Do I have to keep adding Patreon subscriptions, though, every time? Because Cece's getting upset.
Well, maybe she should buy her own.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll see y'all. See y'all in the next one. Thank you to the Burning Saviors for the use of the song Pondale's Finest as the intro and outro to our show.
Now, if you've stuck around this long after the outro, since we're back to our regular scheduled programming, I have the last number in the secret code for you guys. I know we missed a couple with the, you know, excitement of live plays. Yeah. So, the last number in the code for the super secret prize is 8. I will repeat that. Number 8. And that will complete the code. Why don't you go ahead and flip that number string upside down and get your prize.
Boobs.
Fantastic.